2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, and he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And so David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord, and he did not go down to his house. Now they told David, "Uriah did not go down to his house." David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." And Joab was besieging the city. And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises, and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then you shall also say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead. And your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." David said to the messenger, "Thus shall you say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, and encourage him.'" And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to the house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Well, I don't ordinarily give movie reviews, but in this case, I'll make an exception. In preparation for this sermon, I decided to check out Hollywood's take on this biblical story. It was the 1951 film David and Bathsheba, starring Gregory Peck and Susan Hayward. I would give it zero stars, less if it were possible. The acting was average. The sets were contrived. The costumes were rather silly. But the poor rating would go for accuracy, for faithfulness to the story as we find it in the Bible. In the Hollywood version, David actually was off fighting in the war, and he had only retreated to Jerusalem for a brief time, a short break when the incidents occurred. When he spied the woman he had and had her brought to him, he, in the movie, gave her an option either to go or to stay. And it was then that she confessed that she had noticed the king as well. And she knew that he tended to walk around on his roof at this time. And she knew that he had gotten back into Jerusalem. And so it was for that reason that she chose to bathe on her rooftop in eyesight of the king. She was enticing him. And as the story went on, she was married to an inattentive husband who only cared about the glory for war, so, you know, that made everything okay. And they had this happy, youthful love affair, going on picnics and things like this. And David was, poor David, was tormented by his loveless marriage to his first wife, who turned out to be a cruel hag, and so, you know, why not seek comfort elsewhere? Because, well, that's what everybody in Hollywood does. Barely mentioned were David's other several wives, except for the hag, but you see, that would have ruined his excuse. Other elements of the biblical story are randomly tossed in at odd places, messing up the story itself, and the end is just plain silly. You can watch it if you like, but I would warn you that it will be only an inaccurate, distracting waste of time. So, what in the world happened to great David? And as we noted last time, it turns out he wasn't so great after all. He was not the Messiah, of course. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the one who is the great model and example for us to follow in his steps. We live in a day of pervasive sexual sin. This is undeniable. It's just everywhere. Remember that Sigmund Freud, the so-called father of modern psychology, argued that all mental problems arise as a result of frustrated, unfulfilled sexual desires, lust that is not satisfied. He himself lusted after his wife's snappy younger sister, so he was probably just kind of thinking about himself. But this nonsense has been used by sinners everywhere to excuse their worship of sexual pleasure, especially sinful sexual pleasure. So what I want to do is walk through this text and give it some shape. I'm going to structure it under three sobering warnings. We must know the charm of lust. We must know the cunning of lust. And we must know the cost of lust. So, first, we must know the charm of lust, and I'm beginning at verse 1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. So the setting is sometime after what we saw before. Israel had defeated Ammon, and the remainder of the Ammonites had retreated to the city of Rabbah, and so it was besieged by the Israelites. And by saying that at the time the kings go out to war, David didn't go out to war, is the writer intending to suggest that David was idle and that his idleness was what led to this disaster? Maybe. He doesn't really say that. we would have to read that into it. And the details of this story really are quite sparse. It doesn't lend us the license to make up a lot of details that aren't there, to do a lot of reading between the lines. Well, anyhow, verse 2, it happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness, then she returned to her house. Well, we're given the detail about her purifying herself, undoubtedly to ensure that we know that the child that soon would be conceived within her was not her husband's child, but was in fact the child of David. And so this is not a charming love story. This is not the stuff of Hallmark. This is nasty. It's an ugly, tawdry, vile lust story. We don't learn anything about the woman or her attitude. We're not told a thing. She may have felt that she could not refuse the king. We don't know. But we do know that David looked and he took what he wanted. I like the candor of the Puritan writer John Trapp as he comments on this situation. This year, he writes, was the 49th of David's age, as is generally held, and the 19th of his reign. To him a woeful year, because left to himself, he, quote, fell into temptation and a snare and many foolish and hurtful lusts. Joseph, a young man, was fiercely assaulted, but stoutly resisted when, lo, David, an old man, and one that had many wives and concubines, is shamefully foiled and made to defile himself in sin's guzzle or throat. What more odious than an old lecher? So to see the sins of youth in an old decrepit goat. Take heed, corruption doth as easily creep into the white head of the old as the canker into the white rose. And we should beware. How many times haven't we, just in recent months, heard of this or that respected Christian leader torpedoed by lust and sexual sin? Temptation only works, you know, because it affords some degree of pleasure. And today, sexual sin is so rampant as to be as common as snow in winter. What do you do personally with the allure of sinful pleasure? What do you do when you notice an attractive person of the opposite sex? This is no excuse at all. Please don't imagine that it is. But, you know, before the days of television and photography, we didn't see the most beautiful people in the world every single day. You only saw the people in your village or your neighborhood. Those are the only faces. Maybe a few dozen. And certainly no one could imagine the flood of filth on the internet that may be accessed instantly by that cell phone that is on your hip or in your purse. And sadly, honestly, I do not think we're winning this war. Statistically, we're getting slaughtered by lust. According to self-reporting through the Barna polling group, I'm quoting, just over half of practicing Christians report consuming porn with some level of frequency, including 22% who view it weekly, that's 15%, or daily, 7%. Though numbers climb among non-practicing Christians and non-Christians, the reality is that a slight majority of all Christians has some sort of history of engaging with pornographic material. It goes on, the effects of pornography are far-reaching. Barna data reveals that porn users often experience lower mental health and overall well-being, along with feelings of guilt, shame, and isolation. I pause to say, duh. Porn use also significantly impacts relationships and trust, even within marriages. Again, duh. So we must know the charm of lust. I'm sorry, it's everywhere. It's tripping up, it's tumbling, it's torpedoing, it's destroying people, families, marriages, inside and out of the church, just about everywhere we go. We must know the charm of lust. We must know the cunning of lust. Lust will find a way. Lust will consume its disciple, its practitioner, and lust will seek to avoid detection, or it will furnish limitless excuses. Starting in verse 5, and the woman's conceived, and she sent and told David, I'm pregnant. That is the sum of her comments in the entire chapter. I'm pregnant. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go out to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Well, you see obviously what David is attempting here. Uriah goes home, and in a short while after this, his wife goes public and says, hey, Uriah and I are pregnant, our first child. Isn't that wonderful? But he's foiled. Great David is revealed as a cheating, lying scoundrel. Well, this foreigner, he's not an Israelite. Uriah the Hittite is a man of true integrity. Verse 12, then David said to Uriah, remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem and that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord, but he did not go back to his house. Here is a common line of self-deception when it comes to lust or greed or other wicked desires. You know, an unfulfilled desire, we could agree, is painful. But let me ask you, is it suffering? Should we call it suffering when someone cannot fulfill a sinful desire? I mean, the fact that I cannot satisfy a sinful desire, is that something that the Bible would call, oh, you're suffering? A married man is infatuated with a coworker. He longs for her. He's beside himself. He lies awake at night next to his faithful wife, dreaming of the other woman. He feels tormented. Is that suffering? Is that biblical suffering? Should we perhaps pity this man? Should we make some allowances for him? Would Jesus pity this man? No, he would not pity this man. He would seek to extricate this man from the sinful grip of vile lust. He would seek to rescue this man. Why is the man tormented? It's the wages of sin. He's feeling it. He's already sinned in his sinful desire. Do you see the cunning of lust? Now think of the rationale given for, say, gay marriage. Well, the poor man is suffering. Poor woman is suffering. Tormented. I mean, how can you be so cruel? How can you be so insensitive to deny them peace and satisfaction? Or here's an extreme example. This is a true example, related to me by a friend in our presbytery. It's about a pastor, not one of our pastors, but a pastor in eastern Iowa, in jail. His wife, he claimed, was inattentive to his needs. He was suffering. So he was justified, he argued, in turning to his daughter. Devious, deceitful lust will find a way. It will furnish excuses. It will justify as you destroy yourself. So we must know the charm of lust, the cunning of lust, and we have to calculate the cost of lust. David switches to plan B in order to cover up his sin. Verse 14, in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. Many point out the irony. Uriah is carrying his death warrant unbeknownst to him. And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Well, by all accounts, this is murder. This isn't manslaughter where, you know, at the last minute someone hauls back and slugs him and he falls on the ground and dies. This is premeditated murder by war. No question. By orders of the king. David drags his nephew, Joab, in as an accomplice to first-degree murder. And David was neither the first nor the last, I think, to commit murder because of adultery, because of lust. But he did commit murder because he failed to control his lust. Verse 18, then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, when you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, Joab knows what's probably coming, then if the king's anger rises and if he says to you, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? You can read about that in the book of Judges. Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go so near the wall? And then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, the men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of your king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. He doesn't wait for the king to be upset. David patiently waits to hear the full report. He's really not terribly concerned about any of the other details, just one. He wants to hear one name. And then he hears the words that he had been hoping for. And so he responds not out of anger, not out of outrage, but out of a sense of relief. David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, and encourage him." Oh, now he was almost home free, so he thought. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when the morning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. He made it. It was close, but he got away with it. He satisfied his contemptible lust. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. So we should be clear, this is not a tender love story between two innocent star-crossed lovers. This is plain lust. Raw, unvarnished, wicked, vile, ugly lust. David only contacted her just the one time. That's all he wanted. Got what he wanted. He only had the further complication because of the pregnancy. And then he had to take other matters into his hand. You notice when she reported that she was pregnant, David did not immediately say, "Whoopee!" and take steps to marry her to secure her for himself. No, his first move was to quickly shuffle her back to her husband. "I don't want any part of this. This isn't love. This isn't even affection. This is sinful, wicked desire." It was only after her more noble husband would not comply with his scheme that he had him killed and then took her for his wife. Well, what else is he going to do? He has to. But that never was the plan. It was never about her. It was about David satisfying his sinful lust for an attractive woman. And it was the beginning of the dreadful downfall. And the downfall of the people of God. Be very sure, sin will take you farther than you wanted to go. Sin will grip you harder than you ever could know. Sin will keep you longer than you wanted to stay. Sin will cost you more than you thought you would pay. Know full well the captivating charm, the crafty cunning, and the incalculable cost of lust, of unlawful sexual desire and pleasure. The Puritan Bible expositor Matthew Henry laments this scene. He writes, what David said of the mournful report of Saul's death may more fitly be applied to the sad story of this chapter. The adultery and murder David was guilty of. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. We wish we could draw a veil over it, and that it might never be known, might never be said, that David did such things as are here recorded of him. But it cannot, it must not be concealed. Beloved, if David suffered trials before this day, troubles, blistering heartaches before this day, they are nothing in compare with what followed these events, these grievous sins. You know that of all of his many sons, and he had dozens of them, only Solomon is said to have any faith at all. His family in the future would be marked with rape among his children, murder, insurrection against David's throne by his most favored son. Let this serve as a cautionary tale. And let me speak plainly. Lust, sexual impurity will destroy you. Its iron grip will never release you until it has poisoned your heart and weakened your witness and polluted your relationships, so that in the end you will have done more in the service of Satan than you have done in the service of the Lord Jesus Christ. And as Paul solemnly warned Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:22, so flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Let's bow together in prayer. And Lord, help us to take to heart the sad and distressing words of this fall, of this great and godly man after your own heart. And help us to heed the warning that let he who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. And help us to flee youthful passions, and instead, repenting, change directions, and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. We pray in Jesus' name, amen.